Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 61, section 6, which is old single column page 700. Okay, so we just have the last little bit of the Cenozoic, and in our journey to the present through all these hundreds of millions of years, the most recent of the recent era, as it were. Remember, Cenozoic means recent life, and we got to the final in the past block of time that geologic epoch that is called the Pleistocene, the most recent. Right? So of all those chunks of recentness, right, we have this most recent, except for, just a tiny little footnote that we'll get to at the very end, what we're in right now, the mode we're in right now. And that most recent, that Pleistocene, is defined by the Ice Age. It begins when the Ice Age begins, it ends when the Ice Age ends. That entire geologic epoch is the Ice Age. Okay? And so if you look back to section 5, you can see that we started there with what they entitled the Early Ice Age. And technically what that implies in the context of the whole Ice Age is the first half. Right? It's basically 2 million years. And if you look down in section 6, you can see we're going to be hitting 1 million years ago. So what we've covered is the first 1 million years, the first half of the Ice Age. And recall that there were 6 advances of the ice, and 6 major advances of the ice. Okay? And we've gone through the first 2 of those 6 in that first half of the whole Ice Age. So as you see, you'll see when we get into this, they'll talk about the third advance beginning. So in terms of the complexity of the Ice Age, most of the complexity is yet to be gone through. And, it kind of reminds you of how the closer we were getting to humans, and now we're actually going to get to humans, you have this greater and greater precision of relationship between all of the, what initially we think of as environmental aspects, relative to the evolving life. But of course, as I've been stressing, if you step back, you recognize that there really isn't life and then the quote-unquote environment. It's all just one system, all evolving together as a whole. And so, more precisely, what you're seeing is you think about how much precision and complexity is coming into existence to finally get the first 2 humans relative to an amoeba, say, right? The environment, too, is getting this greater complexity. The plants were getting the greater complexity. The animals are getting the greater complexity. The environment is starting to get more complex and is going to start having this very short time scale relationship to humans, supplying a little bit of cattle prod if humans need a little bit of cattle prod, or giving humans a little bit of luxury of climate if humans need a little bit of luxury of climate to get civilization going. The environment is going to start to have this wonderful, be in this wonderful dance with the humans.
So does that mean if we keep going down this trail of becoming pre-primitive and no law, breaking laws, law is not even important anymore to some of the people on this planet in America, that we're going to have the environment and so we have tsunamis.
Worst. One would not, one can't guarantee, but one wouldn't be surprised if the environment joined in to help nudge mankind back in the direction that we should be headed. Right? And because it's a vast conspiracy. That's kind of what I'm getting at. Yeah. There's this whole vast conspiracy. Fundamentally, ultimately, of an infinite scope that you're in the midst of, and there's no escaping. You have to face the responsibilities, and develop the requisite self-control to be involved in that which is ultimately infinite harmony, ultimately, resistance is futile, right? As the Borg, used to say back in Star Trek, right? You must comply, right? I mean, if you're going to exist. I mean, you can get out of that compliance by choosing to cease to exist.
So self-assertion isn't going to work.
Right? But no amount of self-assertion is going to overcome infinity. Right, and eternity, and it just is. And you can scream and squint and flail all you want, and it's not going to change infinity. You've lost the inertial battle from the get-go. So it's everyone has to eventually face that and just recognize that it's if you want what you will come to recognize as best for you, that's to be found by synchronizing with the plan, right? The infinite plan. It's fundamentally what's best for you. No matter how much it might not seem initially, you got to know it is.
Right? God knows what's best
for you. Right.
Whether you believe it or not. Because you certainly don't.
Yeah, and just... But of course, a lot of people think they do, right? I mean, they start to get that self-righteous sense,
and they know what's best for you. But you do have a part of God within you that helps you go towards what you believe to be God's will, what's best, be perfect, that kind of thing. So there is some truth in the fact that you have to play your role. You just, and you have to keep growing that way. So you do measure what you think is best for you, but ends up being. Yeah. Well, what the adjuster's plan was in the beginning, they say, predestined, but you don't have to choose, you don't have to take it. But if you're smart, you do, because it's the best thing for you.
Yeah, and we definitely all have our place. We just have to think about it logically. It's like, well, okay, so if I definitely have my place, but it's this elaborate, perfect plan, I'm going to have to develop the skills to be precise enough to work in the midst of such a finely tuned, absolutely perfect system. And you could say, well, I was just born perfect, and and every time I move my hands, it's with perfect precision. You could believe that, right? But there's all kinds of experiences that tell you otherwise. No matter how much of a prodigy, say a musical prodigy is born, they still have to practice. It's not like none of them, practiced zero, right? Just sat down and were as they were as perfect at it, from the get-go as they were 50 years later. And it just, everyone knows it doesn't work that way. None of us are born finished. Some of us are born a couple steps ahead. I mean, some evolutionary things are eventuated more, right, in the beginning of some than others. Right? There is a spectrum of how much evolution is eventuated in your beginning. But no one has the end from the beginning, no matter how much of a child prodigy they are. Okay, back to the point here of of getting into what we've been building and building up to. We've been stressing this whole time that we've been reading, even before we had the implantation of life with those first single-celled plants, even going back a trillion years when we were just getting, this basic region of the Milky Way together, that it all is, has been in truth the evolution of the will creatures of this planet that they've been talking about. Well, finally, that fact is going to manifest. What has long been there in truth is finally going to manifest in fact.
And the other planets, if you're going back a trillion years.
right. But the whole point is, it's the history of your rancher that we're reading here, the title, right? That's the focus. They're giving us all this because, they're focusing in on our world, and we're about to have an inhabited world. Yeah. So all of those, the extent to which they've mentioned other worlds and other suns and all this sort of stuff, for the immediate purpose here, it's just that is the greater context that has to be in a certain way so that we can be. Now you can flip it around. We have to be a certain way for some other inhabited world to be. Yeah, sure. But we're focusing initially on all of that. Initially, seems to be a vast scheme so that you can be. And there's a validity to thinking like that. That's not, well, I think I'm the center of the universe, and so let's just make everything serve this world. That's not in fact the case, but there's a truth to that. Every world is managed, loved, exists in a context as if it was the only inhabited world. Right? So there is a truth. When you think about, we just mentioned History of Your Ranches, the title of the the part we're in, and that word Urantia, that coinage, now purely technically, the capitalizing of the U would mean the heavenly place. We probably shouldn't say the heavenly place. There's lots of heavenly places. We're not the only inhabited world, say, right? So we could say it means our heavenly place, or if the revelators are speaking to us, they're saying it's your heavenly place. But that's thinking factually, like I said. But in truth, it is the heavenly place. Right? It's managed as if, cared for as if it is the only inhabited world. As if it is the heavenly place.
Of course, we had a couple of bad managers for a while.
Yeah, but that's just because they were trying to make sure that it was better in the end than it would have been if they had stayed on the straight and narrow. They didn't recognize, but they were part of the vast conspiracy too. No matter how much they want to go to iniquity and make things bad, no, they make things better. You can't make the whole worse. Everything you do, even going to iniquity, makes the universe better. It's a vast conspiracy because all of your finite activities are encompassed by supreme mind. Doesn't matter what you do. It's going to take whatever you do and make good out of it. That's what the supreme mind does.
Right. It doesn't mean
Right. We may have to suffer through it.
Right, sure. There's
doesn't
yeah.
mean go but to but in the making good.
But in the end, right? I mean, you don't go. Well, yeah, I know that the only way to make a supreme adjuster is for a will creature to choose iniquity. So I'm going to take one for the team. I'm going to go for iniquity so that you know I can make a supreme adjuster. You know, that's silly, obviously. But you know, you flip it around. Every mortal will creature, right, that does go to iniquity, even though it's a difficult thing to achieve, is it not immediately obvious that good was made of that? You made a supreme adjuster out of that fact.
Okay. That's kind of hard to understand.
Yeah. That the only way that the adjuster can get that supreme nature is to function in contrast to that negative. It's like I always say, the whole point of your existence is to experience negative stimuli and to not have a negative response, but to choose to have a positive response to a negative stimulus.
Right. Kind of like my son says, Dad, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy?
Right, and the only way to be happy is to have a negative stimulus that you choose to have a positive response to. Joy is when you have a positive response to a positive stimulus. And that requires no will. That's just a fancy machine that has that stimulus response. Right? But only when there's a negative stimulus and you choose a positive response do you have a sublime pleasure in your mind, transcendent of joy, called happiness. That's the whole point. If you live in Havona, you never have the opportunity to respond to a negative stimulus. There's nothing but positive stimuli in Havona. Right? From our perspective, it's a dead battery. Right? The whole point of our existence is to be immersed in negative stimuli and to choose to be a human, rather than just a fancy response, a helpless victim of antecedent causation. Okay? That's the whole point. And that gets us to this. There's about to be a delightful environmental stimulus that's very difficult, called the Ice Age. And mankind is going to be plopped right into the middle of it. And it's the beginning of the test. I mean, the moment that the first humans are born, they're born into the test. You know, they don't get a few years before the Ice Age starts. No, they're born right smack in the middle of it. Right? Test on day one. Right? Figure out how to handle this or freeze to death.
Yeah. Right? You don't have to cut the cord, you just kind of shatter it.
Right.
It kind of breaks off.
Okay. It's just right here in what we're reading. All this stuff that seemed like a tangent we were just talking about, right? No, it's right here. The whole point of our existence is to be born in the midst of difficulty and to triumph over it. To have no choice but to choose, you know, as it were. No option but to choose. To choose to do something positive, what appears to be negative only. Right? Okay. So let's just jump in here and see where it goes here.
6. Primitive man in the Ice Age. The great event of this glacial period was the evolution of primitive man, slightly to the west of India, on land now underwater and among the offspring of Asiatic migrants of the older North American lemur types. The dawn mammals suddenly appeared. These small animals walked mostly on their hind legs, and they possessed large brains in proportion to their size and in comparison with the brains of other animals. In the 70th generation of this order of life, a new and higher group of animals suddenly differentiated. These new mid-mammals, almost twice the size and height of their ancestors proportionately increased brain power, had only well established themselves when the primates, the third vital mutation, suddenly appeared. At this time, a retrograde development within the mid-mammal stock gave origin to the simian ancestry. And from that day to this, the human branch has gone forward by progressive evolution, while the simian tribes have remained stationary or have actually retrogressed.
Okay, now, I think everyone who's been reading for a long time knows the whole next paper expands on all this. They just give you this little thumbnail sketch here, in context. And so, we won't get into all of the details. We want to kind of notice what they emphasize just in this little thumbnail sketch. The first thing that jumps out at you by having it all condensed into one paragraph, because they're trying to get you to the truth, not just the fact, you see the word suddenly italicized over and over and over and over and over again right in front of you, right? Right. You see this geometric crescendo. You know, what long appeared to be just an arithmetic evolutionary process, more and more spirit energy, is in play in the mind energy rather than just physical energy. And so you start to get a more and more geometric phenomenon of this mindal over control of the evolutionary process. And once it basically has searched in that horizontal space, that horizontal evolutionary process, and found the path up, it's boom, 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 boom. Right? In very relatively short order. I mean, you notice that he literally described the span between two suddenlies, not with years, but with generations.
And these are generations of primates.
Of relatively primitive creatures, yes. Right. So just saying it that way is to stress just what a crescendo we've reached, that it's found what it's been looking for. The path to Andon and Fonta is in sight, right, in the evolutionary system. And it proceeds, directly, right? No, sidesteps, it just zoom, goes straight to that, that goal. Right, so that's one of the things that the truths that they're trying to emphasize here. Now, the basic geography, we'll get into those details, but you notice something I've been stressing, in response to like your questions about why do they keep talking about North America, right? Here they're reminding you that it's that western center of the three centers of life implantation and focus, our focalization, plays the initiating role in this. Coming out of that North American stock, which is now at this point North American, not just the western part of the one continent, and coming across the Bering Strait and down through Asia and over into Central Asia, you get the initial creatures that are going to go boom, 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 boom vertically up to humans. Okay, you see how they're emphasizing, big steps, right? I mean, literally, not only just 70th generation, so it's short, but then almost twice the size and height of their ancestors, right? So mom and dad give birth to these kids that, immediately grow up to be twice their size. Yeah, plus they're not even the same species anymore.
Right? And big brains, too.
Right, much bigger brains than everything to go with it. Because obviously what we're moving toward is being able to have the requisite engagement of the fifth adjutant, so the engagement of the fifth to a greater degree so that the sixth can seed upon that greater fifth, and then the seventh can seed on the sixth. Right? We're finally going to get to the point where we can max out the fifth and have the sixth engage it. And that's the point of them taking our word primate, kind of sort of using it the way we use it, but not exactly. Right? They're using it in a much more specific way, in a much more literal etymological way than we do. Okay? And just to emphasize that, they capitalize the P. Right? So, you know, just so you don't immediately think, you know, primate, like we tend to just use that as a general noun. Right? But prime, right? Primus, first. Right? In other words, you know, these are the primacy animals. Right? The max, you've maximized animal. Right? First in the whole pyramid of animals, right? At the top, right? At the apex. You know, they're using that term in that literal sense. It's first, right? It's at the top. It has primacy over all other animals, specifically, you know, mind. Right? Obviously, it does, you know, these creatures don't have primacy of size or, you know, or something like that, or speed.
The last will be first.
yes, right. Yeah, you've got a little bit of the last shall be first. Yeah, good point. Right, the last animal is the quote-unquote first animal, the primate. Yes, it's as high as you can make an animal, and not, you know, have the next step up cross the threshold. Right, and have a brain. Then it, you know, the next suddenly, you know, you'll have a brain that's sophisticated enough that the fifth can fully maximize, and the sixth can seat on that, and the seventh can seat on that, and then it can be encircuited in the Holy Spirit, and a personality can identify with that that spirit encirclement, and right, you've got the whole package.
Why do you think they don't keep progressing? Why do
they just... that's a question that they answer. The reason that it stops is, as soon as you have the first two humans, the mind shifts into a different mode. It doesn't need to be fostering it upward anymore, you know, in the old mode sense of trying to get animals up to humans. It got the humans, and so this is all being over-controlled by mind. Right? If you want to think about it in crude fashion, mind is lifting the matter up, right? And once it's lifted it up to a human level, it stops lifting up, you know, in that animal-to-human mode. Now, it continues to, you know, it focuses in on those humans and works to maximize the human, right? And if Anna Infanta, or, you know, just when they had a few children or whatnot, if they'd all been killed by some big accident, the mind would have shifted back and would have engaged the animal stock again and brought another pair over the threshold. Right? So, again, it's, you know, this whole phenomenon is mind planned, mind made, and mind administered. And it's a mind over controlled phenomenon.
Being the mother spirit.
And creative mother spirit is, you know, our local universe creative mother spirit is the immediate minister of this evolutionary influence, right? God the Mother is the God of evolution. Right? And God the Mother is not a single fact, it's a hierarchical fact, right? There is a God the Mother of all the finite, right? But you can say there's a local expression of personalized mother deity, you know, a local God the Mother for each local universe. You know, that's the finite God the Mother handing off duties, you know, down the hierarchical chain of mother deity. And in a bigger sense, right, there's a God the Mother for the total absentite, right? And the God the Mother for the total finite is a delegated and downstepped expression of that even greater mother, right, et cetera, all the way up to the infinite level. But we've got to, you know, you've got this minister of mind, and hence, you know, see, because it's mind over control of evolution, you see, that's God the Mother is the God of evolution. Right? The Father has no direct relationship to mind.
So the reason that you have the earthworms and all the animals, and they're still here, is because it has to have a link. I mean, does it have to, you know, it can't just disappear and have us? We have to have that still.
There's a remain. Yeah, we talked about that as we've gone through. Yeah. The creatures that weren't just scaffolding that, you know, served to just transition from one state to a higher state and then disappeared. The ones that are ongoing, like earthworms, I'd have been around for a very, very long time. All those ongoing species, fish or whatever it might be, represent the ongoing foundation for seeding mind on this world. Right? Your use of the second adjutant in its highest mode amongst all animal creatures on this planet is predicated on that second adjutant having an ongoing firm foundation for, you know, its foundational aspects, literally upon the ongoing animals. Right? And you don't get out of that mode of needing that ongoing foundation for the, you know, the basal parts of the adjutants, literally being animal creatures, until you get up to the kind of mindedness that a secondary midwayer has, where, you know, it doesn't have the first five adjutants. It just has the sixth and seventh, the last two, and Maranja mind. So it has a foundation from above instead of from below. So it, fundamentally, it has Maranja mind with a little bit of a, you know, poking down of the top two adjutants. See, and they're stabilized on a Maranja mind foundation, but our mind is stabilized on the animals, you know, that use it in the most rudimentary ways.
And always will be that.
Yeah, and it's always like that on worlds. Yeah,
seven stage.
Yeah. No matter how many stages of light and life you get in, there's always going to be animals. Now we've talked about, you know, what animals are the core group that's needed, you know, for seventh stage light and life. I mean, who knows? But you do know that there is a great diversity of animal life on architectural worlds. Okay. So, you know, that does speak to the fact that, you know, it's not going to be down to five species, you know, when this planet's in the seventh stage of light and life. It's going to be complex. All those species are going to be genetically engineered, you know, just like the humans, to have this very final sort of state of life on the planet. But, you know, it is very interesting just how, you know, even though they don't go into the details, you get the obvious sense that it's quite complex on an architectural world. You know, that there's, you know, as a matter of fact, there's even variations of life that we can't even imagine right now. All kinds of different kinds of quote-unquote plants than anything we can imagine, and all kinds of different quote-unquote animals than anything we can imagine, and then things that are kind of a mixture of the two that we don't really know much about at all, except in kind of a super primitive sort of a form, right? You know, single-celled sort of a form. So yeah, it's and you go, well, why is that? Is that just so that, you know, as you're walking through the gardens of Edentia, there's chirping birds? You know, is that the point? No. Again, it's there are material-minded creatures, you know, on all these worlds. Right? And so there's that whole complex foundation for that adjutant mind. It's an amazing physics that we'll one day understand. Okay, let's see, what else do we have here? We got the parenthetical. Let's see, before I get to that, is there anything else I missed there? I was going to notice, just, it was kind of funny the way you read it. The great event of this glacial period, you know, when you said it kind of this glacial period in contrast to, yeah, it's like, well, okay, if you're thinking the six advances for what it means by period, okay, maybe you'd stress this, but, you know, but definitely remember, unlike current geologists, this is the only ice age. One, you know, so by glacial period, you mean this, you know, the ice age we're reading about. There aren't several former ice ages way back hundreds of millions of years ago or something. Okay. And we'll read about this whole bit of slightly to the west of Indian stuff, you know, on land, now underwater. Right? I mean, you know, these details are far enough back that the geography back then was quite different than it is now. So you can't just go to the map right now. I mean, you look in that area that where this happened, and there's nothing but deep sea, you know, bottom there, right? It's not like there's continental shelf or anything like that. I mean, it's just, you know, everything, all that land is completely gone all the way down to deep sea floor there now. I mean, it's all been washed away. So you got to keep that in mind. But let's see. You notice that those dawn mammals walk mostly on their hind legs. And that's an important little thing. Just notice what little details they give you. They're really basic things that, like I said, it knew it was on track to humans, you know, and so things like walking on hind legs, you know, that happens very immediately. You know, it doesn't wait until you finally have, you know, full-on humans. Being basically hairless, that happens very quickly. You know, that doesn't wait until the very end. You know, it goes very rapidly to so that Anna and Infanta, you know, the first two humans, are quite similar, right, to us. You know, they're not like in cartoons, you know, hairy hulking beasts at all. Right? Very completely upright and basically hairless, you know, other than the special hair that we have, you know, on our head and whatnot. You know.
So what about like Neanderthal and all that?
See, and again, you know, those Neanderthals aren't all hairy and all that. Say no. Now we'll get to those details. There is one little caveat. Some of those ancient humans backmated with some of those near human stocks that were hairier. You know, I mean, that's one of the reasons why Europeans can have quite a bit of body hair, you know, on their chest and back and whatnot. That's because of backmating.
With those
near human stocks.
So what is a near? I've often wondered about that. What do you mean by near?
It means they're biologically compatible. You can have children with them.
Like an ape or something?
No. Technically they're in kind of this ballpark of these primates. Mm-hmm. You know, that they're talking about here. They're a very advanced ape. They don't have the sophistication of a brain to have all seven adjutants.
And they talk about it later.
Yeah, and they talk about all that. Right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there were 7,000 different strains that were close enough that you could biologically, you know, mate with them, but they weren't human quality mind. They were just fancy animal. Right? They only had up to the first 5 adjutants. So, you know, any offspring you have with that, you know, it's either going to be a very degraded human, or it might not even be human anymore, that offspring. It might, you know, that mating might drag that offspring down to the point where they're subhuman again.
See, I can't fathom what it would look like, what that would look like in my mind. I've often pondered it. But what does it mean? I mean, like, we have the apes now, the gorillas and stuff.
We've been finding some of the skeletons of those creatures. You know, current scientists think that some of those near human things are the precursors to, you know, to humans, but they aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, we just read about all the precursors, and it's not in Africa, right? But if you find these very advanced apes in Africa, say, those are some of the ones I'm talking about. You know, and is when you finally had genuine humans in Europe. Now, you had some of those very advanced apes, you know, right there next to them, and they were backmating with them and blending in some of that stock. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Not a picky date, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, but we don't want to go off too much on those tangents because that's the whole point of the next paper. Right? We're going to get into all those details. Okay. Right here, we want to just think about, you know, these basic elements. And notice they throw in that one parenthetical. That even though, like I said, we're on this very definitive vertical track of going from these lemur, you know, like creatures up through dawn mammals, mid mammals, primates, humans. boom, 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 boom. There's a little asterisk in the process, you know, or parenthetical, literally, as they have it here, that amongst those mid-mammals, as we'll read about, you had a degraded pair. Instead of a mutated pair that went up to primates, you had a mutated pair that retrogressed. Okay? And I've already mentioned this before because we saw it a little bit. Remember, there's lots and lots of different, monkeys, apes, monkey-like creatures, whatnot. There's already lots and lots of them in existence. But those, that retrogressed pair, I mean, they are quite advanced relative to those lesser animals that are not related to what we just read about. And so as they mate into those stocks, pre-existent stocks that they were biologically compatible with and could mate with, they did tend to upstep that stock a little bit. And so that's what they're referring to there. While the simian tribes have remained stationary or have actually retrogressed, amongst the various monkey-like, ape-like creatures that we have on the planet, they're pointing out some of those actually have that genetics from that retrograde pair in them. Not all, say monkeys or whatever on the planet, but they're kind of giving you that little hint that you could look for which ones of those apes, that we have, might show signs of something not that far back that modified them, right? That there was something blended into them. Okay. They were back mating too, see? But that tended to, produce something that had a relative improvement. When the humans back mated, right, that tended to drag down, although they tell you there were some genetics that we got that were positive from some of those other strains. So it wasn't all bad. All right. Anyway, like I said, we'll get to all those details in the next paper. All right. So now let's actually look at the final step here of getting the first two humans.
Can we read both of these?
Just read the first one. I'll make one quick comment.
1 million years ago, Urantia was registered as an inhabited world. A mutation within the stock of the progressing primates suddenly produced two primitive human beings, the actual ancestors of mankind.
The reason to stop is just notice how italicized, you got inhabited world. Remember, that's a technical term. Right? You now have a world with will creatures. It's a quote-unquote inhabited world. Another suddenly. You notice that there was all of this vertical potential building up, progressing primates, is the way they described them. So you didn't just have these primates kind of just sitting there going nowhere, right? It was building up in those primates for this final spurt up.
Is this Anda and Infanta they're talking about?
Yeah, and so Anda and Infanta are two primitive human beings. Okay. They're primitive relative to Sangiks, relative to upstepped, with Adamic blood. And remember, that's a technical term also, primitive humans. And Anda and Infanta are an exception and a few others, but most of those primitive humans on every world are spirit fusers, not father fusers. So they get just temporary adjusters, right? And then they're fused with a fragment of the local universe created mother spirit when they're resurrected on the first mansion world. Definitely the first pair are exceptional because you want to get the humans off to an exceptional start. So always the first pair of humans are father fusers. They're a cut above. Right? So it makes this very definitive jump up into solid human land, if you will, a solid human domain. Advanced enough that they can actually be a father fuser. But
even some of their immediate
and some of their immediate children and stuff. Yes, but in general, you know, it kind of settles down to a primitive human level where in general they're spirit fusers. Okay. All right. So you can see there's actually quite a few things there. You know, and we see something we haven't seen for a while, registered. Remember how way back, you know, we were talking about registering it, you know, as having life here. First, when the primary associators came 950 million years ago, and you know, and then eventually you've got the first prokaryotic life, and that was getting registered, and so we're reminded of of how much we are being kept track of. Right? It isn't just life carriers out here in the wilderness, and there's only the Pony Express for them to communicate with anyone else, and it takes a long time. Now, I mean, the whole universe is in very intimate understanding of what's going on every world, and the word goes up immediately on high. The trumpets blast. There's a new inhabited world, right?
Okay. This event occurred at about the time of the beginning of the third glacial advance. Thus it may be seen that your early ancestors were born and bred in a stimulating, invigorating, and difficult environment. And the sole survivors of these Urantia Aborigines, the Eskimos, even now prefer to dwell in frigid northern climates.
Climes.
Okay,
so see, there's a number of things there. It's like, oh yeah, that's right. We are reading about the glacial age. So here's that third advance beginning at about this time, and it's obviously not a coincidence, right? It's all part of the vast conspiracy. Is there? Indicating there, they're born and bred in a stimulating, invigorating, and difficult environment. That's the whole point. Yes. Darn it. Yes. Right.
Yeah. Think they have climate controlled
It's called rugged truth, right? Right. I mean, this is the fifth epical revelation is trying to. It's looking for those who are ready to face the little bit more rugged discussion of reality. And see, this is the whole point. The point is that for it to be difficult. And so think about how unfortunate it is when humans spend their whole life trying to somehow set up some scheme to shield them from difficulty. Right? They're missing the whole point. All they're doing is delaying the inevitable. You're going to wake up in the first mansion world where it isn't so easy for you to finagle things, and you're going to be exposed to difficulty because that's the whole point, right, of facing difficulty and not just being a helpless victim of that negative stimulus.
And you don't get to procrastinate.
Yeah. I mean, well, you can procrastinate a long time if you want to take, several hundred thousand years in the first mansion world. Yeah, that's... But you'll just go on and on, right? Until finally you take a deep breath. It's like, okay, I'll face facts. Right? The whole point is to use your free will. Right? You're not using your free will until you are imposing a positive response in your mind to a negative stimulus. Anything else doesn't require personality. Everything else just happens automatically. Your mind is a very sophisticated thing, and it has all kinds of fancy functionings that have nothing to do with personality and free will. But it's a helpless victim, right? If there's a negative stimulus, it can only have a negative response. And until you get above that mind, use your personality, grab a hold of spirit, and impose that spirit direction down upon that mind properly. You could grab a hold of that spirit and impose upon your mind and make your mind have an even more negative stimulus than it would naturally have. You could do that as well. Right? But the whole point is to use it in a productive way, that spirit over mind, right? To say, no, I am not going to respond negatively to that stimulus. I'm going to respond positively to that stimulus.
You call somebody, you hit a tweet or something, and you say, you idiot. That's not so good.
Right? Or, you know, and think about how everyone is delighting in not being a person these days. You know, where everyone thinks that the whole point is to be offended. Right? That you have a right to be offended. Matter of fact, you have a right for me to respect you being offended. That's taking delight in cultivating not being human. That's a fancy animal. Fancy animals are offended, not humans. Humans choose to not be offended. Okay? And the moment that you choose to not be offended, guess what? What happens to that whole forgiveness thing? Poof, that whole complicated thing disappears. Right? If I don't take offense...
We're truly being tested
right
now.
Or you can forgive and take the high road.
Right?
But it's kind of like the, what, revel in disappointment, you know, and stimulated by things like that, which you kind of seem like they're contradictory, but...
Oh, you can feast on uncertainty, and disappointment, and lose in the face of apparent defeat. That part?
That's what he's talking
about. But you see my point. I mean, the point is not to eternalize this mode where, wow, you really, you know, treated me very poorly there, but I'll forgive you. That's not an eternal state. That's children of God are in that mode. Adults of God have transcended that. Adults of God don't take offense, so they don't have to forgive anyone anymore. I don't have to forgive. I don't take any offense. You know, it's okay. I understand that a little child doesn't function in perfect ways. I don't take an offense at that. Right? I mean, you know, a parent learns this, right? Is that with their biologic child?
Hopefully.
No, hopefully, right? I mean, right? It's like you start it naturally with the parent-child relationship. Just continue that. Take that on up, right? The little child, does something immature, and you don't hate them for the rest of your life, right? I told you not to poop in your pants, and you did it anyway, and I'm going to hate you for the rest of your life. I mean, is that what a biologic parent does to their... No. No. You don't take offense in the first place. You may have an initial little biologic instinct to have a negative response to a negative stimulus, but you immediately catch yourself and go, what in the heck am I thinking, you know? I'm not going to get mad at them. It's like, you know, they don't understand, right?
But mercy comes into play in the universe. And
yeah, but see,
there isn't any forgiveness.
Again, mercy is just the buffer between you and absolute, mercy is, I'm not going to apply absolute law to you, John, yet. But eventually I will. And you'll be ready for it. Right? Mercy is, okay, we'll start gentle. Right? I can't expect you to be absolutely perfect on day one. So I'll put a buffer called grace between you and absolute law. Right? But eventually, as a fully matured adult of God, you will relish at the opportunity to be exposed directly to absolute law and to perform perfectly in its presence.
Probably meet not as a human on this world.
Not in this world, of course. But you know, when you come face to face with an absolute law, when you're standing on the Isle of Paradise, mm-hmm. right? There's nothing in the environment except absolute law. Right? You have to conform absolutely. Right? But you work your way up to that. You know, you get into Havona, right, and you have the laws of the house, the economy of Havona, right? And you've already gotten to the point, you know, where you have perfect consecration of your will. So already there, you can perfectly, you know, conform to the laws of the house in Havona, because right? There's no allowance for not. because that if you didn't, that would be a negative environmental stimulus, and there are right there are no things right. The environment for every being is positive, perfectly so. Right, so for you to go in there, you can't be a big rock in the pond, right? You have to conform precisely. So you start with the immediately transfinite and work your way up through all the absonite law conformity until you can conform to absolute law in the Isle of Paradise. And for the first time, you are free. Right? Right? Thy liberty in law. Right? Thy absolute liberty in absolute law. Right? Okay. Like I said, there's all kinds of tangents that I knew we'd get on. The moment you start talking about humans, it gets very exciting, and there's lots of tangents.
Kind of experience of the faith of Jesus. You know, but you can somehow experience a little bit of that here today with that faith somehow, where you understand it. But I want me to go on here.
No, let me just make a couple more comments, kind of more to the point here. We get off on these tangents. So just the specifics that they give us. Okay, so we have the third glacial advance, and we have this whole bit of stimulating, invigorating, difficult. And we'll read more about this whole little tease that they throw out about Urantia Aborigines, the Eskimos. You had basically that initial andonic stock, you know, in a relatively pure fashion that started heading off of Europe, over towards North America, way back when. There was some mixed blue stock that followed over there and blended into them. Okay, so there is that qualifier we'll learn about when not to mention in very recent times, of course, you get a little bit of red man, you know, that's gotten blended in too. Okay, but in relative terms, those Eskimos have the least non-andonic genetics, okay, of any peoples on the planet.
Least non-andonic.
The most andonic, yes. But you see why I said it that way, because everyone is mixed now, like they tell you. There's some degree of mixture in everyone. But they a lot of times they just, you know, they skip those factual details and they speak like this. And you don't want to overplay that, right? They're giving you the truth, right? And in the truth, those are the Urantia Aborigines, but not in precise fact, okay? There is a little bit of other stuff blended in to the Eskimos. And then the final little thing. See, even now, they prefer to dwell in frigid northern climes. Why did they tell you that? Is it just for the fact of it? Again, why are they telling you that? Oh, they're saying that we're designed that way. That's actually designed into us, that the life carriers designed those single-celled plants so that eventually when you got the first humans, they would have an instinct to go north toward stimulating, invigorating, difficult environments. Right? And lesser creatures go for salubrious climes. Right? You know, and humans still sort themselves that way, right? Those that have a little bit more of that programming that was meant to be there, you know, don't shy away from the difficulties of the northern climes. And then there's those that seek the salubrious, lay on their back and wait for the dates to fall in their mouth, right? Yes.
Vacation every now.
Okay, we'll grant you occasional vacation, but you're going to be guilty while you're doing it. No, you get my point. Yeah, we're not supposed to be guilty about occasional.
It'll probably rain and hurricane.
Right. I mean, even in your ascension career, right? I mean, it's this this almost nonstop, challenge. But, you can't sustain that without a breath, right? I mean, even in your ascension grace, okay, you need a rest for a while, right? And you get to do a little bit of a horizontal, rest, before you engage the difficulties of going vertical again. I mean, that's fine, right? Rest is part of the plan. But just, right, don't flip it around and make work the exception, right? work needs to be the rule.
I have a couple of things to bring up.
Yep.
I believe that it's true that people are healthier in colder climates, our climate. And also, there was some thought a few years ago with the mitochondrial, some kind of testing that they did on the in the Aleutians, where some people think that the first woman came from that area.
Yeah, okay, so there's, for those of you on the webinar, one of the things she was bringing up there, it's a tricky thing of geneticists trying to look at, both basic chromosomal DNA and then also, the little circular chromosome in our mitochondrial DNA and trying to guess at sources. And that's a very complex thing. That involves a lot of false vistas, if you will. It's inescapably, humans can't sort out all those details. That's why a lot of those details, as we go forward from this paper, the relators give us a lot of those details about exactly who was where and when, because we can't figure that out ourselves. And so they're allowed to give us a lot of those details. And giving us those details, we can then take our data, studying, the details of mitochondrial DNA, and we can kind of calibrate that. We can interpret that data in a better context and more properly interpret it than we are now. We have some assumptions that we use to make those interpretations that get us on false tangents. That the revelators try to help us with. Let's see, and then the other thing you said, that whole bit about salubrious clime, right? I mean, there's just a lot of things that are, why we're genetically programmed, if you've got some giddy up, to go north and away from those salubrious climes. I mean, there's always going to be more disease there. And kind of more to your point, there's going to, your body is meant to be in a mode where it is being challenged to always be pushing itself upward in nature relative to those negative stimuli. That's the way you're designed, to sort of stay in an upward-oriented mode internally. If you remove those difficult environmental stimuli, your body tends to just kind of back off and not be so upwardly oriented, right? And you just naturally going to be more susceptible to all kinds of physiological issues. Remember, this is very much so because we didn't get the biologic uplift. If we'd gotten that biologic uplift, see, then we kind of have a foundation that's bounded up above that, and you don't have to sort of be cattle prodded up, right? You kind of naturally stay up there, above the level where there's lots of problems, if your physiology is kind of down in those lower domains of functioning. Right? But in the absence of that biologic uplift, the only way is to have this stimulus and have your body responding, okay, I've got to go up, I got to go up, I got to keep going up, to stay above this assault, right? It keeps keeps you more healthy.
Nobody ever said, keep it down, keep it up.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so you can begin to understand a lot, without being a scientist, you can begin to understand some of the basic modes of what's going on with your body, right? How it's designed to be related to the environment. Okay, let's read that another paragraph there.
Human beings were not present in the Western Hemisphere until near the close of the Ice Age. But during the interglacial epochs, they passed westward around the Mediterranean and soon overran the continent of Europe. In the caves of Western Europe may be found human bones mingled with the remains of both tropic and Arctic animals, testifying that man lived in those regions, these regions, throughout the later epochs of the advancing and retreating glaciers.
And also reminding you of just how much warmer it can be, you know, in between these glacial advances. You know, it's still at relatively high latitudes. You can get some quite tropic-like phenomena. Right? So remember how they mentioned that you know, things are throughout the Ice Age. It's the climate is continuing to move into the current toward the current mode, where tropical plants and animals are only in the tropics, right? And that's why we call them tropical plants and animals. You know, going from that, you know, being a very narrowly, you know, a very narrow equatorial region where you can have a lot of things, whereas, you know, way before the Ice Age, right, those things could be living at the poles. Right? You had this basically same climate over the whole Earth. And we're moving towards a more and more definitive continental climate where it is definitively colder in the north and the south. But remember, throughout basically this whole Ice Age, these 2 million years, you know, like the Arctic Ocean is not frozen over. It's open. Remember how they mentioned it's evaporating. That's how you can get all that snow, right? If you stop that evaporation off the Arctic Ocean, it's pretty hard to have a whole bunch of precip up there on those highlands to be the sources for these glaciers, right? So, again, it's because it hasn't gotten fully to that mode it's in now, where there's this big differential between the pole and the equator in terms of temperature. Okay, so you can have these, in between the ice advances, it can be relatively mild at some, you know, relatively northerly latitudes, or, you know, or southerly latitudes if you want to go the other direction. All right. You know, and remember the Mediterranean, you know, it was vastly different, you know, bigger and different, you know, morphology than it is now. We've talked about that some. Okay. All right, let's move into the next section here.
7, the continuing Ice Age. Throughout the glacial period, other activities were in progress, but the action of the ice overshadows all other phenomena in the northern latitudes. No other terrestrial activity leaves such characteristic evidence on the topography. The distinctive boulders and surface cleavages, such as potholes, lakes, display stone, and rock flour, are to be found in connection with no other phenomena in nature. The ice is also responsible for those gentle swells or surface undulations known as drumlins. As it advances, displaces rivers and changes the whole face of the earth. Glaciers alone leave behind them those telltale drifts, the ground, lateral, and terminal moraines. These drifts, particularly the ground moraines, extend from the eastern seaboard north and westward in North America and are found in Europe and Siberia.
Okay, so just a little quick geology lesson there. If you're not familiar, there's lots and lots of debris caught up in glacial flows, you know, and you can observe that in just alpine glaciers today. And you'll get a lot of that deposited, you know, down underneath as a ground moraine. You'll get deposits along the sides, so you get long, lateral piles of lateral moraines of this debris, and then a terminal moraine, you know, as they're saying there, you know, just, you know, what is snowplowed right at the end, you know, and so you know that glacier went that far and then it started melting and backing up because here's this terminal moraine sitting there. You know, and underneath, you know, you get these very characteristic drumlin things that, you know, they're elongated hills, you know, and if you look at it from the air, you know, you can have a whole, you know, it looks like some sort of of a strange fabric or something, you know, with all of these things all oriented in a, you know, in a direction, like kind of little spoon-shaped hills, you know, and they're all oriented in the same direction. You can tell which way the glaciers, you know, were moving, you know, by the long axis of those hills. And so you have all this very characteristic, you know, including rock that's ground literally into flour, you know, sort of fineness. You know, and it's called rock flour. So if you're not familiar, and you know, and you can have, as a glacier's receding, you can have a great big iceberg that's left on the land, you know, and it's this massive, heavy thing, you know, that pushes a hole in the ground and it melts and is the initial water in that little lake. Right? And so, like, if you're up in North Dakota, Minnesota, you know, there's all these little lakes everywhere, right? All those, you know, all the little chunks of ice that were left behind and turned into all those little lakes. Yeah, because that it makes the depression. And then that whole, you know, now that the glaciers are all off the continent, right, the continent, you know, is slowly rising because that massive, you know, ice was pressing down. Remember, it's like a mile thick, you know, even up at the front edge of it. And, you know, walk up to the southernmost, you know, face of the, you know, and it's a mile high wall of ice, right? So, you know, all the way up, you know, through, you know, United States and up through Canada, you have that massive ice pressing down on the land. You get, you know, take that load off, and, you know, the land is just, you know, rising still today. So you took all the water out of the ocean, dropped the ocean level, put it on the land, you know, pressed the land down. Okay, and then all the ice melts. Okay, and the ocean comes back up again, but the land is, you know, is rising too, and so, you know, you get these vast differences in coastlines.
So we don't have to worry about Florida.
No, Florida was never had ice on top of it.
It's still a sandbar.
Yeah, it's just a sandbar. Yes.
But the Arctic.
Right, but you know,
is
the, you know, all of Canada, right, you know, is rising. Yeah,
back.
Yeah, is rebounding. You know, and we're talking hundreds and hundreds of feet on all these various, you know, differentials I'm talking about. Yeah. So, yeah, like I said, I think there's like 500 feet. You know, if you take into account both the changes in the ocean and of land, I mean, you know, you got hundreds and hundreds of feet that things have changed. And so, when we think about, well, you know, what if the ocean level changes, you know, a few, you know, inches or something, you know, and it's like, okay, guys, I mean, this has changed a lot, even in recent times.
Plus, a rising ocean is going to push the land,
Right, yeah, and then there's that whole bit, as the ocean, yeah, you know, that presses down on the bottom. Right, there's all, it's a vast, complicated hydrostatic problem, right? Yeah. Okay, let's see here. So, you know, you got the classic things of like the Finger Lakes, you know, in upstate New York, right? You know, those, you know, they're like fjords, right? You know, that's just the ice that's carved those cleavages, and all that sort of stuff that we know is so characteristic, you know, or just a beautiful, you know, a bedrock face that you know has all these fine striations, you know, where you can see how the glacier with grit, you know, embedded in it was grinding over that thing just like sandpaper and putting all these fine lines, you know, on that rock surface. And of course it's smooth, you know, polished smooth, and then, you know, it has all these fine lines in it. So all those fun things that you can, if you've ever explored glacial country.
I think that's why the Ozark Mountains run east and west instead of north and south.
Yeah, we'll see here in a little bit just how far south the glaciers went, you know, as we read forward here. Let's see, anything else there? You might wonder why they're focusing on eastern seaboard, north and westward. I mean, that's a great example if you look at an aerial photo of that whole region, you know, like they're, you know, in New York, say, you know, all these drumlins, you know, it's just, you know, and this beautiful tapestries-like thing all over that whole region. There's lots and lots and lots of them. Okay, so now you can see we are, you know, we're going to do some quick bullet points, stepping us, again, just giving brief little highlights, mostly now skipping over the human issues, because we'll take up those details, you know, in the subsequent paper. They're going to quickly step us through and get us to the present day.
750,000 years ago, the fourth ice sheet, a union of the North American, Central, and Eastern ice fields, was well on its way south. At its height, it reached to southern Illinois, displacing the Mississippi River 50 miles to the west. And in the east, it extended as far south as the Ohio River and central Pennsylvania.
Okay, so that's giving you a little sense for this fourth ice sheet. If it wasn't obvious already, you know, they mention it, you know, this is going to play havoc on well-established riverbeds. You send this giant earth mover machine, you know, across the everything like this giant sheet of ice. And so when you think about the Mississippi River being that western border of Illinois, well, you know, it's gotten pushed over there. And sometimes, you know, you have some of those rivers being either literally they're where they are because they were flowing along the southernmost edge of the glacier. You know, it was just a glacial melt, you know, forming a river, you know, at its base and heading southward. Like up in North Dakota, in western North Dakota, you've got the Missouri River there. Right? And on the north side of the Missouri River, it's all glaciated. And on the southwestern side, it was never touched by a glacier. The Missouri River is right there because that's where the edge of the glacier was. It was just water flowing along the glacial face there. You know, so sometimes it's like literally marking where the southernmost extent. Other times it's kind of like quasi, like the Ohio River, like they're mentioning there. You know, that what happened there is you had rivers that were flowing northward at the time. You know, and then they get dammed, and you get a big lake building up there, and eventually, you know, it overflows to the south, and you know, finds and carves out a path to get to the Mississippi River, and you know, now the river flows southward. All this stuff has changed, and of course, the land elevations are moving. Like I'm saying, once you take the load off of it, and there's lots and lots of serious alterations of the topography. You know, in the northern part of the United States that occur because of all these glaciers. I guess we got everything there. Yeah, I'm going to read that next little chunk there.
In Asia, the Siberian ice sheet made its southernmost invasion, while in Europe, the advancing ice stopped just short of the mountain barrier of the Alps.
Okay, so even though it's... they don't give you as much detail. You've got this other ice too. You've got they mentioned it. You have the three centers for North America, and sometimes the centers are kind of working together, and you have a big ice sheet that's really coming from, you know, two or more of the centers. But you also have Europe and Asia that are getting ice. Northern Europe had, you know, quite a bit of complexification because of all these ice issues. It tends to be less of an ongoing issue relative to civilization if it's just, well, yeah, in Siberia there was some stuff, and it's like, well, you know, Siberia is kind of just, you know, a lot of it's just wasteland, you know, still today. So it isn't such a big issue. So you have some bias here in talking about the glacial impact on areas where civilization is more definitive. Keep going. All right, so that's it for 750. In terms of the humans, we'll get into all the details. There was a lot of stuff going on with humans between a million years ago and 750,000 years ago, and we'll get to those details in the next paper.
500,000 years ago, during the fifth advance of the ice, a new development accelerated the course of human evolution. Suddenly, and in one generation, the six colored races mutated from the aboriginal human stock. This is a doubly important date since it also marks the arrival of the planetary prince.
No, we switched.
Yes, you know, there's a fun little footnote to, you know, that we haven't seen thrown in really again. Like I said, since we were way back there at the beginning and we were talking about primary associators and life carriers and scouting parties and stuff like that, right? Been a long time when it's just been those life carriers, right? Since 550 million years ago, other than the master physical controllers, right? It's just been the life carriers up until finally now. And then we've got the Sangiks, right? So, and notice that's a suddenly, right? That's a vertical thing. That's not just a horizontal thing. And so that's why two primitive human beings, right? On our planet especially, we had 500,000 years, of primitive that you don't normally have. Normally, primitive is just a very minor phenomenon that in the early stages of each of the Sangic races, that each go forward from the pre-existent stock. They have an initial sort of transition stage where they're primitive, and then sort of kind of fully get up and running, right? As a human.
So maybe like just a few generations.
Yeah, it may. Yeah, I'm sure it varies a lot from world to world, but right, it might be relatively short, span of time. But here we had, we didn't even get Sangiks until 500,000 years. So you don't get kind of a full normal human mode, until 500,000 years down the road.
Part of the experiment.
Yeah, that's part, and that was all designed. Remember, the life carriers designed that. They wanted what is technically a pre-blended race of will creatures. A race of will creatures that has all six Sangiks in a naturally pre-separated state, within them. So it's like pre-blended. It's kind of like the way the father is not a blend of, of the individuality, unity, differential between the Isle of Paradise and the Eternal Son, right? He's prior to that separation. So, you can kind of think of it in that term. It's like, does that make them, does that give them a degree of father-likeness that's not normal? To have it kind of in that pre-blended state, that might have been part of the experiment. Because definitely you can think about how much the over-control through the mother, through mind, is going on to give rise to six different Sangiks with all their specificity and seeing all that, all right, so... So we got that basic issue, and then, and we had that long delay here. Normally, the planetary prince would come, right around the time that you have the first humans. But it didn't come for 500,000 years here because the prince and his staff come as civilizational uplifters, and these pre-Sangic, the Andonites, these pre-Sangic peoples we had are not civilizable, right? You can't come as a civilizational uplifter with humans that are so primitive that they're not definitively civilizable. I remember, in general, those Andonites couldn't really wrap their mind around grandchildren. That was too abstract.
Couldn't count to three.
And there's all those issues too, but just, when you think about, they could handle that immediate children thing, right? I mean, that's pretty, pretty immediate. It's, it's hard for that to be abstract, but grandchildren, that's like, that was all just way too abstract and intangible, that there's some relate, that they have some connection to those grandchildren, right?
Maybe they didn't live that long.
No, they did. No, that's not why. Andon and Fonta had lots of grandchildren while they were still alive and that sort of thing. I mean, it's not that they didn't live that long. It's just literally, it's hard for us to imagine, not having that degree of abstract thinking ability, right, that you can extrapolate yourself through your children to your grandchildren. But they couldn't extrapolate that far. They just, you know, they had no concept that there was some relationship between that child and them. Okay. So just, you know, think about how, if they can't comprehend grandchildren, how far are you going to get in civilizing these people? I mean, you know, you're not going to get very far. So that's why the prince and his staff waited until you had, you know, more definitively expressed humans with the Sangiks.
Yeah. I wonder if those grandkids had the same thought about grandparents.
Like, right, again, obviously it works both directions. And grandkids are not going to have any concept of grandparents either, right? I mean, it's just that immediacy of parent-child, right?
Maybe that's where Alzheimer's came.
Okay. All right, so there's that little vignette about the humans, but we're done with the human suddenlies now, right?
Yeah.
See, that's our italicized suddenly there. That's the final suddenly, right, that we've been waiting for ever since those single-celled plants.
Doubly important.
Okay. All right.
You know what's hard for me to understand is how, just because they're colored races, they come from one person, one woman, how could they be different? How can they differentiate a race when it comes from one person just because of the color?
Again, you know, that's the whole point of these suddenlies. You know, like that suddenly back there that suddenly you had children that were, you know, grew up to be almost twice the size and height of their parents, yeah. Right? You know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Right, the egg. It's just that one day a chicken hatched out of that egg. The parents weren't chickens.
This group, it may have been, right, if they'd gotten killed or something, it may have been another group.
We all know it's very exceptional for one family to give rise to all the same. I mean, normally... Right, I mean, you get red man, and you don't have anything else, and the red man is the only humans for a long time, and then you get the next one. So it's normally spread out as six parallel phenomena. Here, you just have it all coming up together, right? And you know, you can see it's not surprising, because you, like I was saying, that's why you should think of those Andonites, you know, not as being no colored race, but all of them together. Right? It's a pre-blended race. And you're seeing that literally. All six are within that one stock.
Well, that could make
sense. See, and it all comes out.
Okay. Right?
See? You know, you think of it like it's like there's a sixfold recessive nature, see?
Okay.
And all of a sudden it comes forth. Right? Yeah.
In North America, the advancing fifth glacier consisted of a combined invasion by all three ice centers. The eastern lobe, however, extended only a short distance below the St. Lawrence Valley, and the western ice sheet made little southern advance. But the central lobe reached south to cover most of the state of Iowa. In Europe, this invasion of the ice was not so extensive as the preceding one.
Okay, so just a little thing there. Oh, covering most of the state of Iowa. So the Mississippi River had some issues there for a while. Right? Yeah, we just plowed over the Mississippi River, right, to cover up Iowa. And so just reminder of, like I was saying, I mean, the Ohio River being the phenomenon that it is right now, that's not a very ancient phenomenon. You know, and the locations of lots of rivers is not a very ancient phenomenon. Because of the glaciers, they just totally reworked. Other places that have never been glaciated, you know, you may have a river that's been going there for a very, very long time. Right? There's a lot of antiquity to it. But other areas here, right? I mean, it's very, very recent. You know, we don't have the Great Lakes until we're, you know, as we read here in a little bit, until we're kind of all done with this glacial stuff. And you don't have the rivers like they are right now until you're done with all this glacial stuff, because they're getting radically changed. And we saw them mentioning all three of those lobes there. But, you know, just the one thing that you can note there by mentioning St. Lawrence Valley, you know, you're thinking, oh, yeah, well, that must have a lot to do with exactly what the ice ended up doing with the terrain there, exactly where the St. Lawrence ended up flowing. And so you're getting this. You know, if you think about the rivers, you know, in North America, they have this kind of a V-shaped sort of thing, you know, with the Mississippi in the middle. See, and that's because you have this ice coming down in this, you know, fashion, and really, you know, carving that whole area above that V, you know, in various ways, and then, you know, the untouched part below.
Just the east and the west and extend down very far.
Yeah. Right. That's the see. So it gets this V-shaped sort of pushing of things. See. Okay.
250,000 years ago, the sixth and last glaciation began. And despite the fact that the northern highlands had begun to sink slightly, this was the period of greatest snow deposition on the northern ice fields.
Okay, so we little hint there. You know, we know that when all is said and done, we're not going to have these massive 30,000 and greater foot highlands up in the north there, like started this all off. So, and they're giving you that little note there that they are starting to get, you know, whittled down, but not to mention being pressed down, but you know, they're obviously getting carved, right? You know, you're on the sixth glaciation now that's been carving away at those source highlands.
Right? So they're gone today.
Right, and so, you know, most of that is just gone today. Yeah.
In this invasion, the three great ice sheets coalesced into one vast ice mass, and all of the western mountains participated in this glacial activity. This was the largest of all ice invasions in North America. The ice moved south over 1,500 miles from its pressure centers, and North America experienced its lowest temperatures.
Okay, so that, you know, they're giving you that because this is obviously, this is going to be too much for many species. Right, this final punctuation mark, so you're going to get this severe stress temperature-wise and just, you know, extensive forcing of creatures out of areas on a vast scale. You know, they're going to mention that a lot of species, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. Pardon the pun, because there were camels, remember, in North America. and then notice, see, just, you know, along with those lowest temperatures, you know, you get all of the alpine glaciers joining in too, you know, in a way that it didn't before. So
it talks about the three. Is that the ones in Siberia and in Europe?
No, that's the three centers for North America. Just you know, so you got the one that's kind of, you know, the area that's now Greenland, Iceland sort of stuff is that eastern one, and you know, and then to the west from there. I mean, obviously you had stuff going on in Europe and Asia also, but those are separate centers. All right, so, and then just reminds you of a point I made last week. You know, when you have this great, big, extensive phenomenon happening last, you know, it's mowing over all of those five previous ones. You know, so obviously it's going to be difficult to sort this all out. You know, it's not like what happened with the first one is left there pristine. You know, all this other stuff is happening on top of it and erasing a lot of it. And so, you know, it's not surprising that geologists have some difficulty in sorting this all out, exactly when things happened and where and whatnot. So the clues that the revelators give here for glacial geologists are very helpful, okay, for them to help to pin down their analysis of the data, right?
If they only would see.
Yeah.
200,000 years ago, during the advance of the last glacier, there occurred an episode which had much to do with the march of events on Urantia. The Lucifer Rebellion.
Yeah, see, you know, isn't that funny? You know, it's like you see it's an evolution. We've gotten to a point where a whole paragraph doesn't talk about geology. right? Yeah, it's talking about the Lucifer Rebellion. It's kind of sad to record. Yeah. But aside from, you know, what they're mentioning, just the fact that, you know, you've and not only a whole paragraph, but a whole block of an italicized date, yeah, right? Where you didn't mention anything about plants or animals or glaciers or, you know, or mountains or, right? So that just, you know, again, furthers this, you know, we're getting to the point where the story is going to be about the humans, right? And not all of the pre-human phenomena, whether it be creature or thing or whatnot. We're really getting to the point where they're going to zero in on just the humans, the point of it all. Okay.
These glaciers take a while, don't they?
Yeah, and I mean, remember the, you know, if you think back to that first one, remember it was a million. It was 500,000 years out and 500,000 years back, right? And here you've got 100,000 out.
So they move pretty slow.
Yeah, they move very, very slow. But you give it 100,000 years, it can go a long ways, even if it's going slow.
150,000 years ago, the sixth and last glacier reached its farthest point of southern extension. The Western Ice Sheet, crossing just over the Canadian border, the central coming down into Kansas, Missouri, and Illinois, the Eastern Sheet advancing south and covering the greater portion of Pennsylvania and Ohio.
See the V shape? Yeah, they're describing there, like I was saying. And, of course, that just crossing over the Canadian border, I was talking about that, right? I mean, it crosses into North Dakota, but it doesn't go all the way to the southwestern corner of North Dakota. That remained unglaciated.
And the Missouri River.
And that's why the Missouri River is where it is right there in western North Dakota. Okay? And see, they're stressing again, like I said, you know, you're finally going to get the Ohio River and related things into their current state. By what this ice sheet, this final ice sheet, leaves behind and definitively gets everything flowing south to the Mississippi instead of having some northerly route that it used to have. And you can, you know, you can see evidence of the big lakes that were there for a while. You know, they don't mention it right here. Remember, there was one of the big lakes that was there for a long time. There was another quote-unquote great lake, Lake Agassiz, that was, you know, was there to the north and west of Superior. Okay. It was only there because it was dammed to the north by the glacier. You know, as soon as the glacier receded, that whole lake drained north, you know, into Hudson Bay. You know, but it left behind this beautiful flat land with jet black soil in the Red River Valley, Minnesota, North Dakota border there. You know, it's just perfectly flat because it's the old lake bed there of Glacial Lake Agassiz. Some of the best, you know, farmland in the world, you know, right there. All right, so continue on. You see, they're going to mention the Great Lakes here now.
This is the glacier that sent forth the many tongues or ice lobes which carved out the present-day lakes, great and small. During its retreat, the North American system of Great Lakes was produced, and your ancient geologists have very accurately deduced the various stages of this development and have correctly surmised that these bodies of water did, at different times, empty first into the Mississippi Valley, then eastward into the Hudson Valley, and finally, by a northern route, into the St. Lawrence. It is 37,000 years since the connected Great Lakes system began to empty out over the present Niagara route.
Okay, so, and you're going, oh, that's interesting. Just shortly after Adam and Eve, is when you had that in place. So you can see we're definitely getting down to very recent times when we see events that are lining up with Adam and Eve showing up. And you notice also that they're saying anti-Urantian geologists have very accurately deduced, like I was saying, obviously in the wake of the final glacier, right, it's all just there and we can look at it and sort it out pretty definitively. It isn't something that got erased, several times. So that's the point I was trying to make. But all the stuff before that, right, that they've mentioned, even though they've been kind of sparse, it's still every little thing they mention is a gem for those geologists, a date, and specific locations of things to help them sort out the confusion. Just as we'll see when we start going through the history of humans, right, to help us sort out the whole history of humans. Without the little details they give us, it's just hopeless.
The Great Lakes are emptying, so eventually they're going to empty too.
Well, there's all these issues of, you're carving Niagara Falls back all the time, right? And eventually that's all going to go away. And, yeah, there's going to be a lot of changes. You've got issues of that rebounding, that things are, the land is rising. That's obviously going to slowly change what the Great Lakes do with time. And, Erie and Ontario are not super deep, relative to Lake Superior, for instance, So some of that is obviously less, is more tenuous than other parts of it.
Right. We're talking about uranium for irrigation.
All right. Anyway, yep, so those little details.
100,000 years ago, during the retreat of the last glacier, the vast polar ice sheets began to form. And the center of ice accumulation moved considerably northward. And as long as the polar regions continue to be covered with ice, it is hardly possible for another glacial age to occur, regardless of future land elevations or modifications of ocean currents.
And so they're just reminding you of what it took to get it going. You had to have that land elevation, right? And the ocean currents, helped to set up the proper precipitation. But if you put a cap on the evaporation,
but that's all melting now.
Right, but you don't have the land elevations. I see. That's what they're just pointing out. That how key that was and how important it is to because the geologists can't really figure out what causes the ice age. They keep stressing that. You got to remember that Arctic Ocean was open, even though you got these continental ice sheets. The Arctic Ocean is open. And it's evaporating. It's not as cold as it is now. And it was open. So there's all this evaporation right there, raining 20,000 feet of snow down on that incredible island. Right.
And so, which then went downhill.
Yeah. And it just flowed downhill. Yep.
John Stevens has a question about the previous paragraph. Mm-hmm. Is the North Dakota oil shale on the southwest side of the Missouri River?
You're digging down below anything. It's just, the way you can tell that you don't have glaciated terrain is because you have the badlands in southwestern North Dakota. See, those badlands are obviously just, very old horizontal stratified just sedimentary rocks, and you go to the north side of the Missouri and right, there isn't anything like that because, it's just been all snow plowed. About the only thing that was big enough to not get completely just planed down to nothing is the Turtle Mountains, as they're called. Some big hills that are right on the Canadian, North Dakota-Canadian border in the center of the state. See, if you have a big enough pre-existent, rock mass, even when you send glaciers over it, there's something left. But most of it, it's just totally flattened. All right, let's see. We read the first paragraph there, didn't we?
100,000 years.
Yeah, let's see. Is there any, I think we talked about everything. There's a whole bit about, that I was just stressing about.
So we're not going to get another glacial age.
Yeah, and
not for a long time.
And so see at the end, as we get down towards the end here, the polar ice caps are part of the ice age. It's just they're what's left of it. You know, I mean, eventually the Ice Age will be totally gone and those polar caps will be gone too. And the way they were kind of hinting at that is the center of ice accumulation moved considerably northward. And see, that's that little hint that, you know, that that's what those polar ice caps represent, is just that last ice sheet retreated all the way to the North and South Pole, and it's all that's left of it. And at some point in the future, yeah, it'll be totally gone. And the question is, well, what's going to bring that about? Well, we see that the story more and more is involving humans. We had a whole block that didn't mention anything about, like I said, mountains or plants or whatnot. Right? I mean, you got this question. I mean, is that still there as the reservoir for, you know, you've used the Carboniferous that was laid down for us, all those fossil fuels, like we talked about. You put some of that carbon dioxide back in the air, you warm up the earth a little bit, that's what brings the Ice Age to an end. You know, that might be the way it's supposed to work. I mean, obviously, by the time you get deep into light and life, the whole planet is going to be very temperate, like an architectural sphere, right? There aren't tundra wastelands on architectural worlds.
With highlands, though,
yeah,
mountains, perhaps.
Yeah, well, there's all those whole issues of, you know.
Takes quite a while for them to go.
But eventually, when you get to the fifth stage of light and life, the master physical controller is going to take control of the Earth. I mean, they're going to stop plate tectonics. They're going to stop all the radioactivity. You know, there aren't radioactive elements on architectural worlds. All 100 elements are stable. There's all these things. You know, the only reason you have the Earth is still molten in the center and you have plate tectonics is because of all that radioactive decay.
Probably still have rain, right?
So between, yeah. I mean, but yeah, you know, but you got to speculate that somewhere between the fifth stage of light and life and deep into the seventh, there might be really radical changes. Maybe all the mountains kind of get eroded down, and you know, you got to wonder how that all plays out. Yeah.
David Jones is asking, so does this mean, as seemingly implied, that if the polar ice caps melt, that we will have another ice age?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. No, see, I mean, you got to. You can easily interpret it like that. I mean, John was just, you know, bringing that up. You know, see, the key thing to remember, you could obviously imagine ocean currents modifying for some reason, but how are you going to get that vast highland, 30,000 foot highland there, right? right. It's just, we're just, yeah, so.
Product continental drift, not crustal.
Right, I mean, you know, that was, you know, like we pointed out, that was obviously, you know, one of the residual big bowed highlands from the prior continental drift sorts of times, right? That got
Antarctica has some pretty high.
Yeah. So. And it got hardened into a, you know, into these rigid highlands, but then the glaciers ground them down. You know, and so you know, it looks to me like that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even if Antarctica starts going, it's going in the ocean. It's not
yeah,
pushing it.
Yeah. No ocean currents.
I land down there now.
I mean, obviously, you know, the fact that, you know, Antarctica has been glaciated all this time still, right? I mean, it's slowly carving all that stuff down. It's right, grinding all that stuff into dust, into rock flour. right? Right. It might have been high in Antarctica one time, but it's less and less every day.
Yeah. Refreshing drink added to
your ice. All right.
The last glacier was 100,000 years advancing and required a like span of time to complete its northern retreat. The temperate regions have been free from the ice for a little over 50,000 years.
Okay, so this brings in this one here. You know, when do you say that this sixth advance ended? Right. Obviously, that depends on what latitude you're talking about. And so one of the things that they do for us here, when all is said and done with this paper, is give us sort of the best kind of date to mark when it's, sort of effectively at an end. Yes, there's polar ice still, right? But when did that sixth advance end? Humans, have been playing around with this for a long time. And, they're just pointing out, it's like, well, if you're up in, temperate regions, right? I mean, it's, it's like 50,000 years ago when it was free from ice. But, well, what about a little bit further to the north? And is it all just completely relative? Is there no really definitive date where you can say it is now ended? And the fact that humans obviously would have a hard time declaring said date, they give us that date, as we'll see here in a second.
The rigorous glacial period destroyed many species and radically changed numerous others. Many were sorely sifted by the to and fro migration, which was made necessary by the advancing and retreating ice. Those animals which followed the glaciers back and forth over the land were the bear, bison, reindeer, muskox, mammoth, and mastodon.
Okay, so I'll give you an idea of ones that were that could go with the flow, pardon the pun, the most definitively there. And reminding at the end that we still have mammoths and mastodons. Okay, we haven't gotten so far forward that they've disappeared. Like we mentioned before, those only disappear very recently. Okay.
The mammoths sought the open prairies, but the mastodon preferred the sheltered fringes of the forest regions. The mammoth, until a late date, ranged from Mexico to Canada. The Siberian variety became wool-covered. The mastodon persisted in North America until exterminated by the red man, as the white man later killed off the bison.
Okay, so besides the immediacy of that, that's what happened to the mastodons. They didn't die a quote-unquote natural death by the ice, at the hand of the ice or whatever. Notice how they're bringing in humans. And remember, humans are a fundamental part of this whole system. They're not a cancer, right? And when the humans do what they naturally do, that's all taken into account. You can't have hundreds of millions of mastodons running through Cincinnati. Okay, it's just not going to work, right? Any more than you have mastodons, trampling all over on architectural worlds.
Right. To hire a bunch of red men to deal with.
Okay, so this whole bit about all the species that have come and gone, right? And for many reasons, some because other species. Right, sometimes because of changes in ocean temperature or whatnot, right? But it's all really the same thing in truth. You can't have millions of bison trampling through Kansas City or either or whatever, right? We have to keep this in mind. It doesn't mean that we rape the earth. But we've got to remember that this is all part of, this is understood from the beginning. And the fact that you see them mentioning humans playing such a significant role in sort of getting the earth to the point where you can think about some serious civilization, you take it back a couple paragraphs, it's like, do you suppose we play a similar critical role in bringing the Ice Age to an end? I mean, I don't know for certain, but it's certainly a reasonable speculation.
Logical.
Just because of things like, what are they, of all the things they could have told you, they tell you just these few things, and you want to really consider what truth is flowing through those statements, right? What universal thing that goes beyond just the immediate specificity of the fact You know, it's being stated there.
When they mentioned the Lucifer rebellion, you know, the advancement had a direct tie that.
And just, you know, thinking about the, you know, you're going on, you got this wonderful stimulus to get humans going of the glaciers. Huh. Do you suppose somehow in supremacy that there's this decision, quote unquote, that the glaciers weren't enough of a stimulus? So you put a cherry on top, threw in a rebellion? Because you see, right in the midst of the glacier, oh, this isn't enough stimulus. Let's increase the stimulus.
Where's that other knob we wanted to?
I know. I mean, is it not suspicious when you read it in context like this?
Yeah.
Some place in the universe has to experience.
Some place in the universe has to have glacier and rebellion.
And
default. And right.
Nails and
yes.
Hanging on the cross and everything else.
It's a good anvil, but where's that hammer at?
Yeah. Okay, wait, hold on 1 second here. Just make sure before you go on. I think I got everything, didn't I? Can we get off these tangents? I know there was one other thing I was going to mention. The radically changed, again, like I was stressing with the topography, you know, that they were just saying that, you know, the topography you know right now is quite recent. You know, it was radically changed not that long ago. And the same is true with, you know, with a life. You know, it's very important for us to remember how recent the current state is. We tend to existentialize, right, radically. Right, and think, well, it's been like this forever. No, it's so recent. Right. Remember, we're getting to the end of the most recent, the Pleistocene. That's one of the truths that's flowing through here, just how radically different things were just a short time ago, just, you know, a few tens of thousands of years ago, right? Red man came over to North America and ended up killing all the mastodons, but he came over 85,000 years ago, right? He's in this block of 100,000 years, you know, forward, right? You know, very recent in the scale of hundreds of millions of years like we've been reading about. All right.
In North America, during the last glaciation, the horse, tapir, llama, and saber-toothed tiger became extinct. In their places, sloths, armadillos, and water hogs came up from South America.
Okay, so just, you know, throwing in that some of it just died off naturally. The saber-toothed tiger wasn't such a nuisance that humans just finally killed them all off. Right? They just, you know, ceased to be upheld by the system and ceased to exist. And remember, they mentioned this, you know, they mentioned Red Man and then they mentioned the horse. Remember, they touched on that way back, that the horses were gone well before Red Man arrived. And see, that was 85,000 years ago when they first came, you know, into northern part of North America.
The horse had already migrated to Europe. I mean,
the horse was all over from here, right? But you know, in terms of the ones that remained in North America, the glacier did them in.
Did them in, yeah.
See, okay.
The enforced migration of life before the advancing ice led to an extraordinary commingling of plants and of animals. And with the retreat of the final ice invasion, many Arctic species of both plants and animals were left stranded high upon certain mountain peaks. Whither they had journeyed to escape destruction by the glacier. And so, today, these dislocated plants and animals may be found high up on the Alps of Europe and even on the Appalachian Mountains of North America.
See, have you ever think about, you know, some of the plants and animals that they seem like they're kind of out of place? Shouldn't these creatures like be up in the north, you know, northern latitude somewhere? Well, they got shoved down here from the northern latitudes and then up in the high altitudes, and there they remain, marooned at high altitudes, right? Displaced way to the south of where they kind of naturally would be.
That would sure give scientists, or has probably given scientists real trouble and real, let's just let the, you know, the rationalization go on and on and on about.
Well, you know, it's amazing, like they have this thing on recently, Planet Earth is being shown on, and they have the leopard, you know, the snow leopard. Well, that's still a leopard. And you don't normally think of a leopard as being up on the top of the mountain ranges, you know. I mean, so maybe that's one of an example of, not that there's hardly any left, but.
And it's just the picture that you're kind of painting there. You're picturing these poor creatures, they're being driven by this ice sheet, and it's like, it's getting way too hot for, and then they're driven with higher altitude. And then there's like ice all around them, they're like on this island, out in the middle of the ocean, only it's an ocean of ice, and they're marooned up on top of this peak. It's kind of.
Then they became polar bears.
All right.
The Ice Age is the last completed geologic period, the so-called Pleistocene, over 2 million years in length.
See, that little note there, see, over 2 million years in length. They're about to tell you, it officially ends here at 35,000 years ago. So that's why I said, you don't know exactly, over 2 million. It's like, well, okay, so the Pleistocene, let's say, started at 2.1. million years ago. You have to put together all these little pieces to kind of figure out where to draw the lines. All right, so we got this finally, our little note. When should we officially say it the Pleistocene is at an end?
Over 2 million years.
Because, if it's all about the ice, and, the ice is all gone in the temperate regions, over 50,000 years ago, where do we draw this line?
35,000 years ago marks the termination of the Great Ice Age, excepting in the polar regions of the planet. This date is also significant in that it approximates the arrival of a material son and daughter and the beginning of the Adamic dispensation, roughly corresponding to the beginning of the Holocene or post-glacial period.
Okay, so 35,000... as part of the market. A lot of geologists, have decided to make the line much more recent, that like a third that. 11,700 years ago or something like that. Yeah. Okay. But see, they're saying, no, if you it really is in truth done there at 35,000. Yeah, and then there's a little footnote, excepting in the polar regions of the planet. So they're just reminding you, those polar regions aren't some subsequent phenomenon. They are part of the Ice Age. See, it's what's left of it. So in fact, it's not ended yet, even now. But in truth, it ended 35,000 years ago. See, and that again, that points to the fact of, all right, we're not going to get another Ice Age. Right. And coincidentally, end quotes, just as soon as this rough cattle prod stimulus was over, now it's time for biologic uplifters to come, And we know that Adam and Eve didn't come once the ice was done. When did they come? They came when, once that all of that potential had been actualized that can, through the evolutionary process in the human stock, when it reached its peak, then they come. Well, coincidentally, is it two different evolutionary systems or one evolutionary system? See, right? It all works together in this incredible, inscrutable way, right? That's not being micromanaged by power beings and life carriers. It's all in supremacy. It's all in the wholeness. Okay. And this most recent part is called the Holocene.
Holocene.
Right? And, a Holocene, that it's literally means holy, recent. Okay? And I'm just trying to stress, you might say, well, you could say that means entirely recent. No, it's more appropriate to take it as it appears to be wholly recent, because you literally see that you have the whole all in place, right? There's been parts for hundreds of millions of years, or even hundreds of billions of years, parts that have been working together, and it's now all come together into a whole that Adam and Eve uplift. Right? It's appropriate to call it wholly recent. You know, it's the beginning of the wholeness age on the earth. Right? All this complex thing had brought it together. Yeah, so you know, it's pretty interesting that we decided to call it the Holocene, and that you can recognize that there's a truth there that those who coined that usage didn't appreciate. Right? All right, you know, for them it's just the post-glacial period, right? It's just a fact.
Well, they don't know.
Right? But see, we're trying to recognize the truth. Right? It goes beyond a statement of fact about the present age. You know, and so all the more so, if you want to be part of the present age, you need to take delight in cultivating, consecrating your mind to the whole. Right? It's the Holocene, not the Partocene. Right?
What scene are you part of?
Okay?
The Holocene.
All right.
This narrative, extending from the rise of the mammalian life to the retreat of the ice and on down to historic times, covers a span of almost 50 million years. This is the current geologic period, and is known to your researchers as the Cenozoic, or recent times era, sponsored by a resonant life carrier.
Okay, maybe just the one little thing to note there is the parenthetical, which is kind of touching upon, in M dashes, the current. We were talking about there's going to be a lot of earth changes and life changes between now and deep in the seventh stage of light and life, but just appreciating from now on more and more, it is something that's mind made and personality managed, right? And we saw that the beginning of that time is very definitively when Adam and Eve arrive. Because besides being biologic uplifters, they're the one that start teaching, genetic modification, genetic engineering, and right? They start to really teach how to begin to personally manage things. Okay, and not just say, oh, it's all innately divine. We just lay here and bask in its perfection. No, more and more you have to get yourself under control so that you can wield, like we were talking about. If you're going to go to Havona, you have to get yourself into such incredible control that you can work with flawless precision, right? You know, there can't be one little divot in your execution. Right? You're not allowed in the doors. If there's even the potential for there being a divot, right? You have to have perfection of purpose in order to get in the doors, the keys to Havona.
But you don't have to do that with your present mind and your present...
No.
But the whole point is that's the ideal. That's the ideal, and you want to start striking towards that. The ideal is not that nirvana thing. You know, where more and more you let go and it all is just automatic and natural and you melt into it. No. More and more you... See, more and more, it's the exact opposite of that fairy tale.
There is some patience involved. Yeah. There is some, you know.
I know.
You can't go. You've got to go over, as you say, just learning in this. It goes at a specific pace, even the evolution that we're talking about.
All of it has, all of it, you know, my hour has not yet come. All of it has a timing that doesn't change that, you know, point. That's, you know, relative to eternity that you're heading towards, right? And you're trying to, eternity, you know, is not an absolute drop of water in the ocean. It's absolute individuation and absolute self-control. It's absolute integrity. And so you want to strike, striking step for that, right? Do your best today to be a little bit more in self-control than you were yesterday. And eventually you'll be able to handle the absolute law of the Isle of Paradise. But there's all the grace and mercy that you'll ever need to get between here and there. But the whole point is you're going there. You're not going to the absolute escapism, you know, from personal responsibility and self-control, or you just melt into the ocean. And that's not where you're going. That's not your destiny. All right. So we'll get into the immediate story, of how you got the first humans, and then a little bit about those Andonites, and then as I was saying, I think I might have even said the next paper, not technically the next paper, the next few papers where we start to get through, exactly how those humans evolved, like in getting from the first two humans to the Sangiks and all those details, which are a lot of fun. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.